Okay, I'm viewing this shiur, Be'ezras Hashem, as a sense, in one sense, as a new beginning. But we had some of you with us. This is actually a continuation. Starting Sefer Shoftim, I've been giving shiur on Sefer Yeshua for the last year, but I kind of consider that experimental. And so therefore I'm just going to say now that we're going to take a little bit of I'm changing the methodology somewhat. Whereas up till now it was all outside, this time, Be'ezras Hashem, we will actually read the psukim inside. However, if you've been by other shiurim of mine, this really doesn't mean that you need to bring a sefer. You'll be fine without one. But there will be that change of approach. Now, I'll also say, tonight we're going to start with some general preface, very essential general preface to learning Tanakh in general, and move on to a specific preface to Sefer Shoftim. So I want to also stress that while I was so satisfied with the shiurim on Sefer Yeshua, and I put in a lot of effort since then to refine the way I'm going to approach it, and therefore I ask that we're not going to have the shiurim on Sefer Yeshua actually uploaded. There are about 3 or 4 or 5 shiurim of preface, which if you do want, if you're going to be hearing the shiurim regularly, it might be a good idea to that we will be putting up as a Hashem. I think a few of them are already up, the general introduction to learning Tanakh and to the approach, that it's a good idea to take down and listen to. It'll be helpful for understanding the approach. Other than that, I will say that if people on a private basis are interested in shiurim on Yeshua, I would make them available. I just don't want them to be up because the mice, I don't really consider it experimental, and it's not. I took steps to improve the whole mahalach since then. Be'ezras Hashem. Okay, that's the technical part. So now let's start. We'll start by saying that learning Nach is very difficult. People don't realize that it's difficult, and therefore mistakes about Nach, Tanakh abound. If learning Tanakh is easy, you can assume, and please don't be insulted, you can assume that you're learning it off. Right? If learning Tanakh is easy, you can assume that you're learning it, that your method is off, your approach is off. Therefore, I consider this shiur one of the most difficult that I give, and the most delicate. Now, so I want to first outline what I mean when I'm saying this. There are 3 main difficulties that we have to overcome if we want to properly approach Tanakh. That's besides just misunderstanding really what Tanakh is about. But there are 3 main difficulties. First of all, people often have preconceived notions. I assume that everybody here was exposed to Tanakh, Nach, on some level. And when you just learn the Psukim without being guided very clearly by tradition, you get a very, very wrong impression. Nach can be very misleading. It's almost like you read it, and the general impression of anybody who learns Tanakh is that the Jewish people of earlier times were a lousy bunch. Nach is full of castigations, full of blame, and basically what I'm trying to do here in a big way is come and show that how that is very far from the truth. But in order to be able to appreciate that, we have 2 more obstacles to overcome. And that is, number one, we have to really be able to tap into the reality of those times, which is very difficult for a person who's not living in those times. And number 2, which is kind of the same idea, first of all, the standards of earlier times, and second of all, the reality of earlier times. So, yeah, again, like we just said, in general, Tanakh is very, very critical. From the Torah down through Nevi'im, right? It's very, very critical. The Nevi'im were always blaming people, and therefore we always get the impression that they were sinners, we're okay. Yes, people in general right? Period of the first Beit HaMikdash was mamish a disastrous period. But we have to realize that Navi is not meant, never was meant to record history. That's not what Navi is. This is clear from the Navi itself. Navi itself is full of references, say from Malachim especially so, full of references to the history books. Right, if you go, if you've been through Sefer Malachim, you see mamish ubiquitous. It tells you a few things about a certain king, and then it'll say, if you want to know more about this king, Hen Ksuvim al Divrei Hayamim l'Malchei Yisrael, Hen Ksuvim al Divrei Hayamim l'Malchei Yehuda. Want to see more information about this king? It's recorded in the history books of the king of kings of Yisrael, the kings of Yehuda. So what's the purpose of Navi? Well, at another point, who wrote Navi? The Nevi'im. You needed the Nevi'im to be historians. All Jews knew how to learn and read and write, as opposed to the other nations. All Jews knew how to read and write. They were taught that from early ages. Nevi'im had to be historians. Couldn't be anybody else who could record history. And the answer is that Navi was not intended to teach history. We don't know the stories. We don't know about the figures of our past from Navi. We know about Tovar HaMelech from Navi. We know about Tovar HaMelech because we're a part of his nation and his memory is still alive. Right? Just like we set the example, George Washington. Americans don't know about George Washington because they opened the history book. The history book certainly helped to preserve his memory, but most Americans have heard of George Washington before they read about him in a history book. And it's been that way since the time of George Washington. This is what we call Masaira. Masaira is not a religious thing, per se. It's very important in religion, but it's not a religious thing per se. And therefore, for example, let's say, if you see the Navi saying all kinds of things about Dovid HaMelech, about Shlomo HaMelech, and then Chazal come and tell you, people who think that Dovid HaMelech did an Aveira is making a mistake. Oh, come on, the Navi is full of it. 1 minute, Chazal is telling you, 1 minute, where's the starting point? You don't start gathering information about Dovid HaMelech from Navi. You start with what we know about Dovid HaMelech because we were his people and we knew him. After you understand his greatness, after you understand his sublimeness, now you go back to Navi and see what it has to say about him. You'll get a whole different perspective. The Navi is very, very harsh. Because what is the Navi? Again, it's not history. What it is memos for within the family. Meaning, Hashem has very, very high expectations and demands on the Jewish people. And at that time, Hashem was in a much more direct, open and hands-on way being mechanic the Jewish people. The fact that we don't have Nevi'im today yelling at us does not indicate that we're better than them. Look, Yirmiyahu and Yeshayahu are full of accusations about idolatry. So the reason we don't have Nevi'im today is because we're not idol worshippers, and therefore there's no need for prophets. Right? We improved. Right? We made it. No. The reason we don't have Nevi'im today is because we wouldn't be able to handle the Musar of the Nevi'im. That's why we don't have Nevi'im today. We're not on the level to be able to relate to Nevuah. And a generation that had Nevuah was automatically a much greater than a generation that didn't have Nevuah for two reasons. Meaning the fact that there's a Nevuah both is an indicator and a reason that they were greater generations, because only generations that were on the right level had Nevi'im, and the fact that they had Nevi'im made them greater people. Hashem was pushing them for greatness, and he was in a hands-on way pushing and pushing and pushing relentlessly, and this was expressed in the very harsh terms of the Navi. I'll give a few examples. These are just examples that we should use. Again, the people who have been with us for Sefer Yeshua, this is old news, still worth reviewing. But this is very fundamental. I'm doing it now in abbreviated form. Again, if you want to hear it in full detail, listen to the introductory shiur that have been posted. But just a few examples. How the Navi embellishes Averis. The purpose of the Navi was to find problems. That was the job of the Navi. It wasn't to record history. The purpose of the Navi was to find problems and to focus on them with a microscope and blow them up and give it to the people over their head. And the tiniest dots were magnified into huge monsters. Why? Because Hashem expected even better perfection. And as long as Hashem saw that it was working, Nevuah persisted. When the system started failing, when people were smaller people, when they couldn't handle it anymore, when they started becoming resentful of the Nevi'im, slowly Nevuah started waning. We see, right? The fact is that the earlier kings heard the harshest things said about them and they took it in stride. Later kings started acting against the Nevi'im. Right, David HaMelech. The chet of David and Bathsheba was publicized in David's lifetime. Why? Because of the yelling of the Nevi'im. We don't understand, we don't live in a time of monarchy. We don't understand how unthinkable that is, that someone should be able to go around and publicize the king's sin. Today we're used to headlines talking about national leaders, but it turns out that he's not everything he thought he was, or that he is everything he thought he was. So, right? Today we're used to that. In a time of a monarch, that could never be. The only area where that happened was in the Jewish people, where the Nevi'im were going around making public castigations of the kings. That was an indication of the greatness of those kings. But then again, we come a few thousand years later and we read the accusations, oh, they must have been a lousy bunch. But the truth is that no, it's because these people were so great that Hashem sent the Nevi'im. Find the tiniest stains and blow them up, and the people will become even greater. The stains will get smaller and smaller and smaller. That was the purpose of the Nevi'im. And I want to show a few examples of this, because we have to take the cases we actually see what the Nevi'im were talking about and use them to understand other castigations of the Nevi'im where we don't know what they were talking about. For example, Navi says all over the place, Vayavid Yisrael, the Yisrael served the Baalim, right? So we have a picture of the entire Jewish nation switched the sign on the shul from shul to Baal temple, and that's it. All the Jewish people were serving the Baal. That is very, very far from the truth. Now let's just show one or two examples of that. There's a pasuk that says, Chata Yisrael. Yisrael has sinned. Forget the exact wording of the pasuk. Mual umual. They have committed a sacrilege. Gam kichashu. Gam shikeru. Gam samu b'chlein. They've lied, they've denied, and they've hid things away. Okay, this is a typical style of a pasuk in Navi, right? Because the Jewish people were a terrible bunch. They were busy giving Hashem a hard time throughout the whole period of Nevuah. When Nevuah stopped, then they became better. So this is a typical pasuk. What? Throughout the time of Nevuah, they were busy making Hashem upset. Now we're better. But now let's look at that pasuk in context. That pasuk appears in Sefer Yeshua. After the battle of Yericho, the Jewish people were told nobody should take anything from the loot. One person did. Achan. One person did. He hid it away. Nobody knew about it, except his close family. And therefore, the Jewish people lost the next war. People were killed. A shocking thing that people should die in battle was shocking. And what's Hashem's explanation? Chata Yisrael, the Jewish people have sinned. The Jewish people have sinned. As a whole, right? A wholesale accusation. One man, people didn't even know about it. So here we see that yes, this is the way the Navi describes it. So let's use that pasuk as a reference point. And when it says Vayavdu Yisrael it's Haba'olim, it's Hashiros, we understand that we don't know. Does that mean two people? Does it mean three? Another example. Yechezkel says, he's describing the Dor HaMidbar. Eshabsoisai chilelu me'oy. They desecrated Shabbos exceedingly in the Midbar. How many incidents of Chilul Shabbos were there in the Midbar? 1.5. What I mean by 1.5? There was the Mekoshesh Eitzim. It was real Chilul Shabbos. And there was another case of attempted Chilul Shabbos, which didn't work. They were told not to go gather man on Shabbos, and people went out to gather man on Shabbos, and there was no man. It's attempted Chilul Shabbos. That is described as Shabbos Chilul Ma'od. We think of it in terms of our times, and our times is Chilul Shabbos, right? There's a lot of Chilul Shabbos. That must have been going on in the Midbar also. 1.5 times, Hashem says, for my expectations of you, that's exceeding Shabbos desecration. This is the style of the Navi. Why? Because Hashem is pushing for even greater perfection. Now it's like this both in quantitatively, like we're just seeing now, Chata Yisrael, the Jewish people have sinned. One person out of millions. Any other nation, by the way, would put that up in the annals of their history. One person took something from the loot. Right? One and 1.5 incidents of Chil Shabbos is described as Shabsoy Sechil Umalay. That's quantity. Now what about quality? Says Shlomo HaMelech served Avodah Zarah, and Chazal come and tell us he didn't really. Let's just understand again how the Navi works. Quality. So there's a very interesting letter from the Rambam, which Ramesh puts this into perspective. Somebody sent a letter to the Rambam, a Talmud Chacham, Chashiv, a person. The Rambam took him seriously, apparently. Writing to the Rambam, he has a problem. It's almost Yom Kippur. And should he say Vidui? He has not committed any of the sins in the Vidui in the last year. So should he say Vidui? Okay. Now the Rambam didn't smirk. The Rambam writes back to him, addressing him with very serious terms. Like, it seems like he took him seriously. Achi Anil Bavi calls him, my conscientious brother. Apparently he knew that this was a serious person and that he meant it. He knew what he was talking about. Now listen to what the Rambam tells him. The Rambam tells him, you can recite Vidui comfortably because you have transgressed every last one on the list. That's a nice thing to get. What's on the list? Right? I didn't do that. The Rambam is telling this person who he takes seriously, you did every last one. What's that supposed to mean? So the Rambam explains what he means. He says, each Avera, when we talk about blatant Averas like Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, murder, he says, actually, each Avera really, there's a whole range of how that Avera can manifest. It can manifest in a more blatant, coarse way, and it can manifest in a much more subtle way. For example, Chazal tell us a person who embarrasses somebody else publicly is a murderer. Right? So there are subtle forms of murder. So therefore, you might be in shul one day, in the time of the Nevi'im, and you might hear the Nabi thunder at your neighbor. Murderer! Right? Now you know that Ein Mikra Yetzei Midei Pshutoi. Right? Everything is literal. So the guy must have killed. The Nabi very likely means that he embarrassed somebody the other day. But that's how it's expressed in the Nabi. Murderer. So the Rambam says this also about David HaMelech. Gilui Arayos. Yeah. Gilui Arayos in the most blatant form is something we would never do. But we know that there are much more subtle elements of Arayos. Acting inappropriately, a little bit too much familiarity between sexes, might very likely be called Gilui Arayos by the Navi. In fact, when Yeshaya accuses the daughters of Yisrael of immorality, it's not very comfortable to read the Perek, because there he actually does go into descriptions of what he meant. When you see his descriptions of immorality, and then you look at from clothing stores, it's not so comfortable. It's not so comfortable. So, Gilui Arayos, Zdus, murder, and Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah. You know, the Orach Chaim says there's a very, very fundamental Orach Chaim when it comes to understanding accusations of Avodah Zarah. Pasuk in Sefer Devarim says, Ki Ores Torah is saying you should destroy, you should smash, sorry, do not bow to their idols, to their gods, and do not worship them. Because you should be smashing and destroying their idols and altars. So the Orach Chaim asks, there's a little bit of a range in between. You shouldn't be worshiping them because you should be breaking them, implying that you're either breaking them or worshiping them. The Orach Chaim says, why is one the flip side of the other? I don't worship Avodah Zarah, but I'm not out there breaking them. The Orach Chaim says something amazing. He says, tolerance of Avodah Zarah is also referred to as Avodah Zarah by the Pasuk. And therefore the Pasuk says, don't worship them, break them. If you don't break them, you're worshipping them. Why? Because the Torah terms tolerance of Avodah Zarah as Avodah Zarah. That's something to think about. So therefore, we have to understand. We have to understand this when we're approaching the psukim of Tanakh. That yes, these were not meant to provide information. These were meant as Hashem's chinuch system, delivered through the Navi, to try to push Klal Yisrael to greater and greater and greater levels. Yes, when a person said something not nice to the other guy, and the next day the Navi roared at him, murderer, he was shaken and he didn't speak that way again. That was how Hashem, like Avigdor Miller said, pressed the good grapes. The Navim, the non-Jews, didn't have Navim yelling at them. Why? Because they weren't involved. The non-Jews, they didn't engage in any of these things. Chazal said that there are two types of flax. My wife said this about spelt and wheat. She's into spelt lately. But Chazal said about two types of flax. There's a higher quality flax that the more you beat it, the more supple it becomes, the more flexible it becomes, the more quality it becomes. And it becomes a higher level of fabric. So the more you beat, the more you beat, the more you beat, the more you improve the flax. Then there's low quality flax. You beat it a little bit in order to be able to work with it, but if you beat it a little more, it starts falling apart. You know who got Nevuah? Nevuah was the high quality flax that was able to handle a lot of beating. Lower quality flax can't handle too much. This is how we have to be understanding it. Now, why is it so important to understand this? The reason it's so important to understand this is because we can approach Navi in two ways. We can either approach it in what's a very common way of approaching it today. And that is, we approach with a arrogant air. We pat ourselves on the back that we don't do these things. We form opinions on the great people of our past. We make psychoanalyses. You ever see these articles explaining why David HaMelech's troubled childhood caused him to... all these psychoanalyses of people who can't even begin to understand how David's toe operated. And you come away from Nach with a good understanding of what this one's problem was and what that one's problem was, and we are much better than them. If so, there's one big kasha. What do we need Nach for today? Chazal tell us that, you know which Nevuahs were recorded? Nevuahs Shehutzrichu L'Doiris. Right? There were more than a million Nevi'im in Klal Yisrael. Only 48 of them had their Nevuahs recorded. Why? Because the Nevuahs that are relevant for all time were recorded. Now, many people wouldn't understand that today. Why is it relevant? What's so important for me to figure out? Alright, I learned it. I figured out what was wrong with David HaMelech. What's so important about that? Right? Why is it so important to have all of your Miyos admonitions against David Zara? If you understand what we've been discussing, that these are embellishments, that these represent very, very high expectations, very high demands, and when you understand through tradition what the true greatness of those people were, you stand to gain an awful lot out of learning Nach. Because all of a sudden, Nach is going to expose you to levels of greatness, to new levels of greatness, new levels of expectation, new levels of what you could strive for. When you see what Hashem's demands really were at that time, all of a sudden start seeing opening before you mamish vistas of greatness. It broadens your spiritual horizons. That's why it's important to realize that. And that's why also, for example, Chazal said that it was a tragedy when Tanakh was translated. Right? We still fast on that day. That was one of the five tragedies of Shivasa B'Tammuz that we fast because of. Shivasa B'Tammuz was the day translated for the first time. The Targum HaShivim. Septuagint, I think it's called in English. When Talmai HaMelech had Tanakh translated for the first time. For the first time, the Tanakh was in foreign hands. What's that? The Torah. I'm not sure. Maybe it was everything. I'm not sure. But even if it was just the Torah, it's the same point. Because the Torah is also full of admonitions. The point is that these were memos that were meant to be studied in the family. Right? If you're part of the family, you know the family style. You know what's going on. You're in that reality, and now you study the memos, you understand what it's really saying. When you approach Tanakh from the outside, and as a Jew today, you can do that, because we're not really a part of that reality anymore. You approach it from the outside, thinking that you have Nach in front of you, you have the Pesukim, hey, you have all the information, you're going to be just completely misconstruing it. You're going to be missing the whole point. So therefore, this is very, very important for us to realize. Our challenge, what we're really trying to do when we're learning Tanakh, is to go back, work backwards, through the Masaira. Really, the only way to connect to Tanakh is through the live Masaira of what we knew those generations to be. To work backwards and to try to get into the reality of those times, and then to hear the Nevuahs from those perspectives, then we'll get the real messages. We'll be able to come away with and strive for what Tanakh was really meant to push us to. And the truth is, it's not going to be comfortable. It's not going to be comfortable, because it's much more comfortable to hear these terrible accusations and say, well, we don't do those things, than to see that all those accusations are very relevant to us and how. So it's not going to be comfortable. It might be much easier to assume the old approach and say, no, hey, mikro yetzim idei pshutai, it's all literal, meant to be understood as is, we are better than them, and that's that. Now, just end this off with 2 points. Just nailing in what we've said before. This misconception is really the basis of, we want to see how far this mistake could go, both Christianity and Islam. Both of them are based on the understanding that Hashem was frustrated with the Jewish people, he rejected the Jewish people, they didn't cooperate with his plans, and therefore he rejected them for better people. Christians of today, what a glorious nation. Right? He rejected them for better people. What's that come from? That comes from looking at Tanakh and seeing that all throughout Jewish history, Hashem was simply frustrated with the Jewish people. Well, actually, nothing could be further than the truth. Hashem was taking the effort to personally craft these people. And Hashem was very, very satisfied with his products. Sometimes, again, you get the general impression that Tanakh conveys, because these are the things Hashem was telling the Jewish people all the time. But then you miss here and there the psukim that really give you a bigger picture. Yisrael Hashem b'chol yisparer, Yeshaya Hanavi says, I glorify in you. The Kuzari says, the Jewish people are Hashem's pride and joy, in the sense that he tells the Malachim, everyone marvels that Hashem is the creator of the sun. Hashem says there's something even more amazing. I made this people into what they are today. How did I do that? Through all those harsh admonitions of Nebuah. That's the truth. You know what it's like? It's like in an army. Let's say, if we'll say for argument's sake, that the United States Army is the greatest army in the world today, the greatest military. If you're going to hear the corporal speaking to the soldiers, what are you going to hear? Are you going to hear them saying, great, you've done a great job? Or are you going to hear them barking at them? Yelling at them, right? And criticizing. So if a superficial comes in, sits down in a U.S. Army base, listens to what's going on, and then he goes and he sits in a Congo Army base, listens to what's going on, he's going to come away saying, the Congo Army must be much better than the U.S. Army. In the U.S. Army, the sergeants are frustrated all the time, they're yelling all the time, just can't get they can't get the soldiers moving. The Congo Army, they're sitting around, enjoying, they're happy. Obviously a better army. You're hearing the sergeants talking in the Nebuah. And yes, you're hearing the inside memos of the greatest army in the world. Now, just 2 words on Ein Mikra Yetzim Idei Pshutai, because at the end of the day, people will be confused by this. Don't we say that Ein Mikra Yetzim Idei Pshutai? Things are meant to be understood literally? And the answer is, yes, sure, things are meant to be understood literally. But before you can endeavor to understand things literally, you have to at least know the style of who's talking. You have to know who you're dealing with. You have to know the reality of the time. Like, for example, this is a mashal he said a few times. And with this, we'll finish this part of the preface. Let's say, in 1,000 years from now, somebody will be reading a diary from our times. And by then, all cultural norms will have changed. Someone reads a diary from our times and he knows that the person who wrote the diary was literal. So he reads in the diary and it says, today, so-and-so offended me. He really messed me up today. And I met him and I said, well, thanks a lot. Okay, here's a person 1,000 years from now. He's reading that and he's puzzled. He's scratching his head. It's a puzzling verse. It says that he messed him up, so he thanked him. Why did he thank him for messing him up? So he looks in the Mefarshim. There are Mefarshim there on the diary. And the Mefarshim say, this is called sarcasm, Balaz. And really, he meant the opposite. Right? We all know that. You say, thank you very much, but really, he meant the opposite. So this guy says, okay, that might be a drash. Right? But at the end of the day, we have a ruling, it creates a midah truth. This person thanked the other for hurting him. That's the pashat, the pshat, and the pasuk. Now, there might be drash, there might be other pshatim, that he really meant the opposite, but that's not the pshut eshal mikra. So they say, one minute. Before you can even try to determine what pshut eshal mikra is, you have to be in the reality of that time, you have to be in the mentality of that time, you have to be familiar with the style of speech. We don't even know Hebrew, we have to realize that. We don't even know how the Hebrew usage, we don't even understand. The Hebrew that we use today is a very, very broad. Anybody who doesn't believe me, open up a Sefer Iyov. Right? The other Sfarma, simple. Open up a Sefer Iyov. You see that we don't know Hebrew. That's Hebrew. You can't make out how one word connects to the next. So what in Mikra to me Pshuto? You have to know how to read Mikra first before you can decide what the literal meaning is. And for that, you have to really be a part of the reality at that time. You have to be familiar with how Nevi'im operated. Okay. That's really as much time as we spent on this. This is it in a nutshell. Again, if you want to hear more at length, and there are those three introductory shiurim posted. Now, we'll move on to preface Sefer Shoftim before we actually start learning, which will, at this point, I guess will be next week. I just want to ask, has everybody here been exposed to the contents of Shoftim, at least like in a general way? Or, yeah? Okay. Shoftim, if we'll just give it in a bit of an overview, Shoftim represents the period in Jewish history when there was no king, before a king was appointed. It was after the land was settled until a king was appointed, which is about 369 years. 369 years of a period without a king. This period has been very much misunderstood, commonly misunderstood, as a problematic period, which again is the impression that you get by reading the Pesukim. It has been understood as a problematic period. A pasuk that appears quite a few times in Sefer Shoftim is Bayomim Ahem Ein Melech BiYisrael. At that time, there was no king in Israel. Ish Hayosho Be'inov Yase. Each man did what was right in his eyes. Superficially, that sounds like a put-down. There was no king. There was no one in charge. Anarchy reigned. Everybody did what they wanted. But here, actually, I'm going to insist on going with real Pshutai Shel Mikra. Analyze the words literally. It doesn't say that people did what they wanted. It says people did what was right in their eyes, which is intended very literally. People lived according to their conscience without the rule of a king. This was actually an experimental period in Klal Yisrael. There was no king. There was no central government during this time. There were Shoftim. Shoftim ruled, but in a much more informal way. There was no central government. There were Sanhedrins. There were Sanhedrins from the beginning, right? Each in their place, but Sanhedrin were not, there wasn't the government system. Sanhedrin dealt with cases that came to them. Witnesses came and reported something, they dealt with it. And they had police to enforce their rulings. But there was no general government, there was no general police. And the Shoftim were individuals, it wasn't a dynasty, right? One Shoftim died, it took a while until a different Shoftim came into place. And I've even heard it expressed, lack of leadership, right? The Jews couldn't get it together, which is complete nonsense. If you just think about it, Forget Prunkai, just think about it from a logical perspective. Every nation had a king. Any time you have a nation without a king, it doesn't take long for somebody to seize power. And here you're talking about a very, very intelligent people. For 369 years, no one seized power. There was one attempt, by the way. That's amazing, by the way. Throughout 369 years, nobody tried to seize power. That is, I doubt that there's anything like that in any other nation in history. Anything, anywhere close to that. Except one person. One person tried. We'll see, we'll get to that. Abimelech, the son of Gidon. He tried to seize power. And he was killed after a short time. And he was very much put down by the Navi and by Chazal. He was a villain. Kipshuta. But other than that, this was a period where the Jews ran on self-government for 369 years. Meaning that they governed themselves. Yes, again, there was Sanhedrin to deal with cases that came to them. But there was no central authority. What's that? What's that? Who, the Jews? Well, what do you mean by united? They didn't need a government.
They didn't need a king.
Right. That was basically the point. They didn't need a king. They didn't need a king. They didn't need implementation of law. This... Now, what was the pshat in that time? This is actually expressed a few times throughout Shoftim. But again, you got to pick up on the more subtle things, on the nuances. When they were appointing Gidon, when Gidon was going to lead them to battle, and they were so happy with his successes, they told him, "You'll rule over us." And he said, "I will not rule over you, nor will my children rule over you. Hashem is your king." Is that just a form of speech? Shmuel said the same thing later. Shmuel said the same thing later. When they did ask for a king, Shmuel complained. And he blamed them for that. And he said, "Hashem is your king." And the Ramchal says that that was really what this period was about. This was a period in which Hashem's reign was directly over the individual. There was no need for someone in between enforcing it. So this was a b'china of Malchus Hashem. It was Hashem and the Jewish people. They did not need the Melech. That's really what the Melech is. What's the Malchus? The concept of Malchus really is, what it's meant to be, is the king implementing the rule of the Torah on the Jewish people. That's why, for example, we know that David HaMelech is connected with the Levana, right? When we talk about the Kiddush HaLevana, we talk about, just as the Levana is renewed, David HaMelech would be renewed. That's the Levana, that's also Midas HaMalchus. Is what? What's the Levana? What's the Levana doing? The Levana is reflecting the sun's light onto earth. That's what a king is. That's what David HaMelech is. There's Hashem, and David HaMelech is reflecting that onto the people. He's implementing Hashem's rule on the people. Up until that point, it wasn't needed. Now, let's understand what was going on here. This was actually risky. Basically, what Hashem was doing, he was taking the Jewish people, in the moral perspective, taking the Jewish people, throwing them into the deep, and letting them swim. Hashem was taking a risk here, so to speak. Meaning, he was actually putting them up to a very, very great challenge. To be able for an entire nation to run properly without government. And the experiment was successful. Again, when we read Shoftim, and we see, oh, there was this problem, there was that problem. Yes, it was Pelegesh Begiva, which, by the way, we'll see soon. There's a lot of significance to that story. There was Pelegesh Begiva, and there was the Pesel of Micha, there was a statue of Micha, right? The period had its problems. Okay. But, so first of all, we have to realize, that's right, Hashem took a risk by telling the Jewish people, you can manage without a government. The whole point was to see if they can live up to it. If here and there were incidents of people who didn't, that's fine. You see that, nevertheless, for 369 years, it was deemed possible to continue that period. Failures notwithstanding. Failures were an isolated failure. Fine. But, in general, this was a success, which was a glorious period for the Jewish people. Just a minute, I lost my train of thought. So, now, and we have to notice that in the Navi, Like we said, the point of the Navi is, again, you go through Sefer Shoftim, you see problems. But when we remember that the point of the Navi is to pinpoint problems, you have to remember. And you note that you don't pick this up, because at the end it describes a problem, and then it says which Shoftim came along and dealt with it, and then it says, Vatishkei ta'aretz arba'im shana. And then things were quiet for 40 years. Meaning, when there was a period when everything was fine and there were no problems, the Navi doesn't focus on it. The Navi focuses on the problems. If 120 years went by when there were no problems, it's not going to get any mention in the Navi. But Tishkai Taretz, oh, and then everything was fine. Then 40 years later, there was another problem. So you're reading the Navi, you get the impression of problem, 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 problem. But actually, when you add up the years, and this is amazing, when you add up the years, which were the periods where they're accused of Avodah Zarah, this, that, which are the periods of quiet, when you add it up, 2/3 of the period is included in those brief little, oh, and then everything was fine for 80 years, and then everything was fine for 40 years. When you add it all up, 2/3 of the period is included in those, and everything was fine. And 1/3 of the period are the different incidents described. That's also something that you wouldn't pick up on that by superficial reading of the Navi. It's the same thing with the Dar HaMidbar, by the way, right? The Dar HaMidbar, bunch of troublemakers, one time after the other, after the other. Yeah, sure, we're reading it Shabbos after Shabbos. Now, every other week there's another problem. And Hashem accused them. 10 times they angered me in the Midbar. Oh boy, what a lousy bunch. Let them think about it for a minute. Do the math. 10 times in 40 years. A nation of 3 million. 10 times in 40 years. That's one incident every 4 years. That's not a bad track record. So again, we have to properly understand what the period of Shoftim was like, was about, in order to be able to understand the things that are described in Sefer Shoftim. So again, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah says, you think that this is an original twist? When I say that, when it says Isha Yosha Beinav Yaseh, that's actually a compliment. Right? That's what we describe. The Navi is saying literally, people lived according to their conscience. Every Jew lived trying to live as Yashar as he can. Now you might say, okay, that's a twist. But Sefer Shoftim is referred to in Nach as Sefer HaYosha. A number of times in Nach. It's referred to as Sefer HaYosha, the Sefer of uprightness. The Gemara Avodah Zarah says, why is Sefer Shoftim called Sefer HaYosha? Because that was the time when Ish HaYosha Beinav Yaseh. Now, if it's just a sarcastic expression, it means that everybody, it was just a free-for-all, that it would be called Sefer HaYosha, the book of Yashrus, the book of uprightness. No! The word Yashar is what characterized that period of history. It was a period of Yashar. This was the Sefer HaYosha of that period. Now, we'll note one other thing. That this experiment was served the Jews in very good stead. I'm calling it an experiment, the 369 year period of Hashem telling the Jewish people, let's see if we can make it just with me as your king, with no one in the middle. Will you live according to my standards? The truth is that that was really the precedent for how we live today. This is to the very, very great credit of the Jewish people. That is the famous story of the king who told Rabbi Shua ben Chananya, had a discussion with Hadrian. And Hadrian said to Rabbi Shua ben Chananya, I'm greater than Moshe Rabbeinu. Because, it says, Ki akelev achai tovin ariyames, a living dog is better than a dead lion. So even if you'll say that Moshe was greater than me, he probably considered that highly improbable. But even if you say that Moshe was greater than me, I'm better than him. Rabbi Shua ben Chananya said it isn't true. Even in terms of the power of a ruler, you're not as great as he is today. So he said, what are you talking about? So Rabbi Shua ben Chananya said, I'll prove it to you. He said, issue a decree that on this and this night, nobody should light fires. Okay? The decree was issued. Nobody should light fires. Then he told him, let's go up to the highest tower of your palace. Climb up to the highest tower of your palace. Let's look around. They came up to the highest tower of the palace. The area was generally dark. But there, and there, and there, and there, there were fires burning, right? There were the people who were doing it in their house, this and that. Couldn't be seen from the outside, but from all the way up there, they were able to see it. Then Rabbi Shabbat Hananya said, let's go to a Jewish area. Let's climb up on the very high place on Shabbos. That was back then. On Shabbos. Completely dark. Now, I don't know exactly what the pshat is. I'm sure they had fires burning from before day. I don't know. Whatever it is, the point is clear. Rabbi Levi Yitzchak pulled the same stunt. It was one time before the Leila Seder. He came in for his Leila Seder. Before he began the Leila Seder, he said, he lived in it was a completely Jewish town, right? He said, before I start the Leila Seder, I have to have a few things. Not Hasidim, you know, the way he worked with Hasidim and the Hasidish Rebbe as well, it can sound as strange as it sounds, what the Rebbe says, right? He said, I need a few things before I can start. I need a pile of Turkish shawls. What was the significance of Turkish shawls? Where they lived in Russia. Russia was at war with Turkey. And Turkish goods were severely illegal. A person could face very, very severe punishment, which in earlier times was severe punishment, for owning Turkish shawls. And it was smuggled, etc. I have to have a pile of Turkish shawls before I start. Something very dangerous to own. No, the Rebbe said, the Chassidim are going to get Turkish shawls. They made a round in the neighborhood for whatever it was, an hour. They came back, a pile of Turkish shawls were on the table. The contraband existed. Then Rabbi Levi Yitzchak said, now I need one more thing before I can start the Seder. I need a piece of bread. No, the Chassidim went out on the mission, again determined they're going to get him a piece of bread at all costs. The Rebbe said, it's okay, it means it's mutter. So, they went out, search, they came back and they said, nothing. What's this? Self-government. The Jews are able to govern themselves. Govern. That's the Jewish people. When people are under the rule of a king, he can't maintain his control in this way. But, that's the Jewish, that's what we described before. The Jewish people are Hashem's product. The difference between the Jews and the Goyim is that Hashem made the Jewish people. He, through his chinuch, through all of his punishments, and through all of his accusations, he pushed them to the excellent nation that they became, and that they still are today. Not on the same level, but still way above any other nation. We have to appreciate this. This is really what was going on in the period of the Shoftim. Hashem was developing this. We have to appreciate the fact that we are incomparable to any of the other nations. I'll give a few simple examples of this. I'm allowing myself to spend my time on this because, again, this is the preface. But, give a few simple examples of this. But again, in order to appreciate what we're talking about, what we mean, when we say that Hashem handcrafted the Jewish people. It says in the Gemara, this is something you can probably ask any goy, he'll probably corroborate it, that the goyim do not believe that the Jews really keep Shabbos. It can't be. And if you think about it for a minute in realistic terms, it really can't be. But it is. It is. I'll give you another example. And those of you, probably people here heard me say this before. We'll end with this. But another example. About Victor Miller said, they used to have the shul was often in contact with different Catholic institutions because the political issues in New York, they a lot of times had common interests, right? The from Christians wanted the same things on the political front as the Jews, and they often worked together, and they sometimes had meetings, the representatives of the shul with representatives of big churches in the area. And at one time, they used to get into friendly religious jousting. So at one time, one of the representatives of one of these big churches said, you folks are so into your moral standards. You think you're so much greater than us? I want to show you what our kehila can do. He pulled out of his wallet a picture. It was a picture of five girls. Rabbi Victor Miller said, you know, in his style, he said, they weren't dressed like Miss Yankov girls. A picture of five girls. He said, you see these five girls? This is the pride of our kehila. These girls have committed to chastity. Meaning, these girls committed to not having a really serious relationship with a male until marriage. This was our kehila boasts. Ah. That's the greatness of a Catholic kehillah. They have five girls who are committed to chastity. So Bavik Miller would tell this and he would laugh and he would say, you look at Arabic sound because you have 700 girls who are in the Shmiras Haloshin Club. Right? Who's talking about chastity in our high schools? And the answer is that because, yes, the Catholic is right. In our reality, that five girls are committed to chastity is a very great accomplishment, and it's even unrealistic. And the Jews of today, our little generation, are living on a level that's above reality. It's not realistic. It can't be. A taxi driver told me this. I had a Muslim taxi driver one time in New York. A Muslim. An Indian. We were able to be friendly, not an Arab. And we started talking about our religions, and he said, yeah, both of our religions don't allow us to interact with girls, but, you know, in today's day and age. I wasn't married at the time. I was 19. I said to him, why? I never touched a girl. You know, since I've been a teenager, I never touched a girl outside of my immediate family. So he looked at me like, who do you think you're kidding? Like, what? Who do you think you're kidding? And the truth is, again, he's right. In today's day and age, it really can't be. It can't be. But it is. Why? Because Hashem could do the impossible. And when Hashem produced the Jewish people, He did the impossible. Hashem says, this is what I can make out of a nation. This was the period of the Shoftim was represented this period. There was no king. It was Hashem and the Jewish people. And Hashem was forging the Jewish people through punishments, through castigations, through the Nevi'im, through blaming, etc., etc. And the Jewish people turned into the great people that they are. This is by way of preface. Bezras Hashem, next week we'll actually begin Shoftim Perek Aleph. Thank you.